Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. As always, we start by looking at the bestseller lists on Amazon.co.uk and the Sunday Times and seeing what new entries there are. Then we'll be catching up with William Coles. He's been a journalist for 30 years and has worked for a number of papers, including The Sun, The Express, The Mail and The Wall Street Journal. His latest novel, Eton Rogue, is based on true events. It's about 17-year-old Carrie now embarking on his final year at Eton. Prince William has joined the school and the British tabloids are ravenous for headlines. Carrie is the mole who is making thousands selling stories to The Sun newspaper. And while he's at it, he's secretly dating a housemaster's daughter. We also have PJ Ellis, a journalist covering relationships, pop culture and LGBTQ plus issues. He's the sex and relationships editor of Men's Health magazine. His short fiction has been longlisted for the Commonwealth Short Story Prize. His latest novel, We Could Be Heroes, is set in present-day Birmingham and 1940s New York. It's about an American actor who is top of his game until he met a local bookseller and drag performer, had no intention of coming out as gay. We're also chatting to Hannah Pilvanen. She is the author of We Sinners, which received a Whiting Award and a Balkans Fiction Prize. Her latest novel, The End of Drum Time, was shortlisted for a National Book Award and pivots around the relationship between a minister's daughter and a reindeer herder's son in 1850s Lapland. Just the first hour. In the second hour, we chat to Angelica Lopez, Maria de Fatima Santos, Toby Clements, and Inez G. Labata.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
The pen's in my hand, ending unplanned. Staring at the blank page before you, open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate.
Good evening. Welcome to the Book Show. We start by looking at the Sunday Times bestseller list, the oldest and most influential book sales chart in the UK, and the one that every author wants to be on. This chart is the most accurate and comprehensive estimation of book sales in the country. Tom Bauer rather pointedly lost out to a book about triangles in the battle for the UK number one last week, but he's now earned the top spot for his takedown of the Beckham clan. It's not the only celebrity biography flying off the shelves. There are two books about Taylor Swift in the charts this week. Matthew Perry's memoir returns to the bestsellers, this time in paperback. It's sold more than 300,000 copies so far. So starting with general hardbacks, just two new entries from last week. At number one, The House of Beckham by Tom Bauer. Number two is MILF by Paloma Faith. Number three, Operation Biting by Max Hastings. Number four is the first new entry. It's called The Science of Plant-Based Nutrition by Rhiannon Lambert, demystifying topics in healthy eating to embrace plant-based living. Number 5, Why Has Nobody Told Me This Before by Julie Smith. Number 6, The Boy, The Mole, The Fox and The Horse by Charlie Mackesy. Number 7 is Wimbledon by Sue Barker. Number 8 is the other new entry. It's Taylor Swift, Era by Era by Caroline Sullivan, the author and music journalist's biography of the pop music phenomenon. Number 9 is The Woman Who Wouldn't Waste by Susan Dalgety and Lucy Hunter Blackburn. It's a lot of names. And number 10 is The Garden Against Time by Olivia Lang. Fiction hardbacks, just 2 new entries as well from last week. At number 1, The Suspect by Rob Rinder. Number 2, This Is Why We Lied by Karen Slaughter. Number 3, When the Moon Hatched by Sarah A. Parker. Number 4 is Murder at the Monastery by Richard Coles. Number 5, You Are Here by David Nichols. Number 6, Iron Flame by Rebecca Yarros. Number 8 is a new entry, In the Place of Darkness by Stuart McBride. The hunt is on for the Fortnight Killer, a murderer who strikes every 2 weeks. Number 8 is Long Island by Colm Tobin. Number 9, You Like It Darker by Stephen King. And number 10 is the other new entry, The Curse of Sins by Kate Dramis. Aya's purpose to save the realm is brought into question. Moving on to Amazon.co.uk and the top 10 bestsellers for this week. At number 1 is Ask Not, The Kennedys and the Women They Destroyed by Maureen Callahan. Number 2, Pinch of Nom Air Fryer by Kay Allinson. Number 3, A Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas. Number 4, The Housemaid is Watching by Freda McFadden. Number 5 is It Ends With Us by Colleen Hoover. Number 6, Things No One Taught Us About Love by Vex King. Number 7, Politics on the Edge by Rory Stewart. Number 8, The Majorly Awkward BFF Dramas of Lottie Brooks. That's number 6 in the Lottie Brooks series by Kate Kirby. Number 9, It Starts With Us by Colleen Hoover. And number 10 is The Housemaid by Freda McFadden.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
TRE.
You're listening to The Book Club on Talk Radio Europe. And keep listening. That's an instruction from Margaret Thatcher.
Joining us on the line now is William Coles. He's been a journalist for 30 years and has worked for a number of papers, including The Sun, The Express, The Mail and The Wall Street Journal. He's back with us on The Book Show to talk about his latest novel, Eaton Rogue. It's about 17-year-old Carrie now embarking on his extraordinary final year at Eton. Prince William has joined the school and the British tabloids are ravenous for headlines. Carrie is the mole who's making thousands selling stories to the Sun newspaper. And while he's at it, he's secretly dating a housemaster's daughter. Based on true events, the rule of Eaton Rogue is simple. The more outrageous the tale, the greater the chances that it actually occurred. Welcome to The Book Show, William.
Thrilled to be with you, Hannah.
It's great to have you back with us. And I love the sound of this one. It sounds brilliant. I couldn't believe when I saw the based on true events bits. Tell us.
Well, it is unbelievably, most of it is a true story. I was working on The Sun as a staff reporter 30 years ago. And they, at the time, they were a little bit leery of having this old Etonian, you know, working as a reporter, because old Etonians are few and far between on the tabloids, particularly The Sun. And then in 95, I had this unbelievably lucky break where Prince William's going to my old school. What happened when he started at Eton was that the tabloids did this deal with the palace that for the entirety of his education at Eton, and if he went to university too, the tabloids wouldn't run a word of his activities. So he could fail all his exams and have all these detentions, and we couldn't write a word of it. But there was nevertheless a huge appetite for stories about Eton. And that meant, you know, any of William's schoolmates getting expelled or doing anything at all that was even remotely unusual was big news. In fact, it was front page news. And what happened in very short order was there were a number of Etonians who were selling stories to the Sun, and I was their handler, and I would meet them up at various cafes around Waterloo Station, and I would pay them these huge wads of cash, £5,000 in £20 notes. And this went on for some time. And anyway, the best of these schoolboys who was selling stories to the Sun was called Agent Orange. And this is pretty much Agent Orange's story of what happened to him in his final year.
Amazing. So what happened to Agent Orange?
Well, Agent Orange would now be about 47 and doubtless now is, some worthy married with children. And I don't know what's happened to him, but I imagine he was a pretty resourceful guy. And so I presume that he's doing okay. But I don't know what his name is. I mean, he was just Agent Orange. And when he left Eton, that was it. And, I don't know. He might get in touch with me, though, and say, Billy, I'm back. And I say, who the hell are you? And he'll say, I'm Agent Orange. I'll say, you haven't changed a bit.
So you met him, but you didn't know his name.
Yeah, I said to him, it's much better if I don't know your name and I just give you the cash, because that way, you know, when these boys started selling stories to the Sun, there was a huge witch hunt, obviously, to find out who the moles were. And the general way that they did it was by bluffing them, saying, we know it's you, fess up. But I coached him, Agent Orange, very severely on Eton's. It's not quite a school motto, but it is the secondary school motto, which is deny, 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 which is a very useful thing to have. And you can see how Boris Johnson used this to good effect during the whole lockdown parties and all the rest. Deny, deny, deny. And so since I didn't know his name, and I said, look, mate, so long as you're not flash with your money and you don't tell anyone, then it will be impossible for them to trace you. And nor did they get him. Though he did riskily take his girlfriend off to Paris for a weekend. And he's told her that he'd won the money at the races.
And I guess that was perfectly plausible.
Yeah, that's more plausible than I sold stories to the Sun for £5,000. Yeah.
So I'm assuming to this day then, I guess William and anyone else at Eton still may not know who Agent Orange is.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I drilled him rather like the spies at Bletchley Park in the Second World War. Do not tell anyone, because if you do tell anyone, you're going to get, because, you know, the secret will be out like wildfire and you're going to get caught. So maybe even to this day, he's never even confessed to his lovely wife that he was the mole. But the other corollary of it was that in those days, 30 years ago, there were a lot of people who were being paid by the Sun, and you had a few people who were anonymous. And so their money was just going through just to Mickey Mouse or whoever. But the taxman would have had a fit. And what happened a few years later was they wanted proper names for all these payments. And after the phone hacking saga, Rupert Murdoch, the boss of the Sun, wanted a clean slate. And he called in the cops, and they started going through all these payments to cops and civil servants for stories. And the result was that about 30 of my colleagues were up in the Old Bailey, charged with bribing cops and civil servants. And they all got away with it, apart from one who pleaded guilty because he didn't know about deny. And so they all got away with it because they said they were giving money to whistleblowers. But the cops and the civil servants who didn't have, who'd given their names over, a lot of them were jailed.
Oh, goodness.
Anyway, so that might have been, who knows what the fate of Agent Orange is, might have been if I'd actually known his name. But since then, the Press Complaints Commission, which runs newspapers, they have, thanks to Agent Orange, they have now slightly changed the rules for modern journalists. And that is, you are now no longer allowed to pay money to minors.
Right. Yes, I was going to ask you how things have changed in the last 20 years or so, because there's been a lot of scandal and a lot of court cases to do with the Sun, particularly, and other big tabloid newspapers, and looking at the kind of ethical side of this. You know, there's a lot of people that think that this is horrendous and wrong.
Well, giving money to minors, it's debatable. Though, when I mean, obviously, I've had a Damascene conversion since leaving the Sun and becoming just a mild-mannered novelist. But at the time, I was extremely hungry, not quite hungry enough to do phone hacking. You know, if these boys wanted to sell me stories, fine. You know, everyone seemed pretty happy about the whole arrangement at the time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that was your job, wasn't it? As a reporter, the whole thing was to get as good a story as you can. So if people were happy
to give me my story.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the whole thing. So things have changed a lot now, then.
Well, I mean, now it's all an irrelevance. The Sun's circulation when I was there 30 years ago on a good day was 5 million.
Gosh.
And now it is so embarrassing they won't reveal the figures, but I think it's certainly way less than a million, and it might even be less than half a million. So you've got people like Prince Harry waging their war against the tabloids and against the Sun in particular. But I mean, it doesn't matter. These tabloids are dying on their feet. They're on the way out. So, you know, it doesn't. News now is disseminated lots of other ways. And so, you know, journalism, there is, with newspapers, there's still a place for it. But, you know, there's not much money in it anymore.
Yeah, it seems very rare that a newspaper breaks a story that you haven't already seen or read somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you get a good story now, you know, you run with it and everyone else is nicking it within 2 minutes flat. If you've got an exclusive picture, that's slightly more difficult to pinch because they've got to credit it. But if it's just a story, let's say it's a story about, your great story is Omid Scobie saying that Meghan's pregnant again, you know, as soon as that's released, because that's a one-line story but a big story, it's all over the press. Everyone's got it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's hard to, you can't claim it then. The person who's broken that story has no right over it, I suppose.
Yes, well, you mean, if Meghan had anything to announce at all, she'd do it through Omid. And Omid could then release it. But everyone else is going to be, there's going to be a feeding frenzy. And poor little Omid with his scoop is going to, in 10 minutes, is going to be forgotten. Must be immensely irritating for him.
Yes. So tell us a bit more about Carrie in your story.
Well, the story is basically Agent Orange's story, but it needed more heft. We couldn't just have an old, you know, an Etonian flogging story to the Sun. And so he is having a, he's fallen in love with a housemaster's daughter, and Eton's got 1,300 boys, and every so often you get a girl at the school. These will normally be housemasters' daughters who are doing their A-levels. And so when I was at Eton over 40 years ago, rather bizarrely, there were two prime ministers in my year. It's Boris Johnson and the Prime Minister of Thailand, Mark Vejjajiva. And there were also two girls. And, you know, that was quite two girls in the entire school. And they were both, amazingly, Emily Bourne and Abby Ray, in my English class, along with Boris Johnson. It was like, yes! I mean, obviously, I wasn't able to chat to them or anything because there were much cooler boys than me, but, you know, it was still nice to actually see a girl in the school because girls are generally, you know, not allowed within 2 miles of the town. And so part of the story is about this girl, Lily, who's at the school, because... You know, if you're a girl at Eton, she's the only girl at Eton. I mean, that is a pretty tough gig that, you know, everywhere you go, boys are looking, geez, there's a girl. And, you know, it's worse to be. So I'm attempting also to get into her head and to look at how she's getting on in this very old school with these 1,300 boys and her with no girlfriends at all.
So how and why was there one girl at Eton? I don't understand.
What occasionally happened would be you get a housemaster who would be so obsessed with the school that they'd think, I want, and, you know, thinking it's so brilliant and wonderful, this education, I want my daughter to come here. And so they'd be dragged after doing their then O-levels or GCSEs, they'd be dragged out of their very nice school where they had all these friends and dumped in Eton. And they'd be boarding in the same house as their dad. But, I mean, suddenly they've lost all their pals and they're just like this weird exotic creature, and everyone is like eyes on stalks. There's a girl, because you didn't see any girls at Eton.
Oh my goodness, poor girl. Well, I say poor girl, maybe she had a great time.
Well, maybe. I mean, I'm still friends with one of these girls who was in my Abbey Ray. Oh. And she started dating a lad in her house. Her father's house. And so she, you know, she got going eventually, but initially it was not easy. But quite exotic. So, she calls herself not an old Etonian, but an old Etonian.
love it. So how many books has this been now that you've written on Eton?
I reckon it's a record for an old Etonian. I have now set 3 novels there. One of them, I'm not holding my breath, but one of them I'm still optimistically hoping will be turned into a film before I'm dead.
Oh, that would be great. Which one?
Well, it was called, it's currently called The Eton Affair. And I think the working title for the film is The Piano Mistress. And it's loosely based on the stories of a couple of friends of mine who had very passionate affairs with their teachers, and one of them with their piano mistress. And so that's the story. And like all stories of first love, Hannah, it ends disastrously.
Brilliant. And I have to ask you, being at Eton with Boris, any thoughts at the time, this is the kind of guy who'd be Prime Minister one day?
Yeah, he was pretty red hot even then. I mean, at 16, he was a scholar. I mean, he was a bright little boy. At 16, he was already a formidable orator. You know, he really could do good speeches. And, sort of gnarly teenage Etonians are a pretty tricky audience. He could have us eating out of the palm of his hand. He was, of course, an immense blagger. And so, yeah, you can see perfectly he had everything it took to be prime minister and to destroy himself. But unlike a lot of politicians today, he could really talk. Most politicians, senior politicians, are not really orators. I'd say the last really good one was William Hague and Tony Blair. But the current crop is like, you know, just schoolboys reading their notes. It's not great.
No, absolutely.
Anyway,
it's lovely to have you with us on the book show again. William Coles, thank you so much for joining us. And if listeners want to get a copy of Eaton Rogue, it's out now and available on our website, tre.radio. Thanks so much for being with us, William.
Wonderful. Great pleasure as always. Thank you.
Talk Radio Europe. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is PJ Ellis. He's a journalist covering relationships, pop culture and LGBTQ plus issues. He's the sex and relationships editor of Men's Health magazine. His short fiction has been longlisted for the Commonwealth Short Story Prize. His debut novel was Love and Other Scams. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest novel, We Could Be Heroes. It's partly set in New York in 1949, but also in the present day in Birmingham. Welcome to the book show, PJ.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. So what was your inspiration then to become a writer, to become an author of books, particularly after all the journalism?
It's funny that the journalism career is kind of the thing that has been the longest lasting, because it almost started in reverse. Like, I've always wanted to be a novelist. Ever since I was really, really young, I was just an absolute bookworm. I read so voraciously from a really, really young age, and I always loved writing stories. And so I studied English at university, and then sort of after that did a couple of jobs in marketing and advertising, and then sort of fell into journalism just because I love writing of kind of all varieties, you know, fiction and nonfiction. And so, yeah, kind of like the journalism stemmed out of just my love of telling stories and meeting different people. And then I've been lucky enough that now over the last couple of years, that's sort of led to the original dream coming true, which is writing books.
Yeah, nice. So before we talk about the current book, can you tell us a little bit about Love and Other Scams?
For sure, yes. So Love and Other Scams is about a young woman called Kat, who is in a very relatable position where all of her friends are much better off than her in terms of finances, career, relationships. That she sort of just feels like she's been left behind a little bit. And she has essentially been driven to the point of near bankruptcy by going to all of her friends' very expensive destination weddings and baby showers and all of those things. And so in order to make ends meet, she's started becoming a minor con artist. And so the story follows her as she attempts to pull off quite an audacious heist at her best frenemy's wedding.
Love it. So how about We Could Be Heroes?
We Could Be Heroes, it's a big gay rom-com. It's set here in Birmingham, which is where I live. And it's about a movie star who plays a fictional superhero, kind of in the vein of Captain America or Superman. And he's part of this big movie franchise. And they come to Birmingham to film because it's super cheap, which is a thing that really happens. we've had Tom Cruise and Steven Spielberg literally on my street.
Wow.
And while filming in Birmingham, he crosses paths with a local bookseller and drag queen, and sparks fly.
Brilliant. I love it. I love the front cover.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'm so thrilled with the cover art. The artist did like an incredible job. It's this glorious, obviously this is radio, so it's not a visual medium, but it's a really fabulous kind of iconic superhero holding his love interest in his arms, and the love interest is a guy wearing high heels, and it's so pulpy and campy, and I couldn't be happier with it.
Brilliant. So tell us a bit more about the American actor Patrick.
So Patrick is very deep in the closet because he's in this sort of, you know, leading man role. And so even when he's, you know, off camera, he's kind of expected to play into a certain type of very all-American masculine persona. And he's sort of... He thinks that he's made his peace with that, and that's the price that he has to pay in order to have the career that he wants. But then when he meets Will, who's the other main character, who is sort of much freer and actually finds fulfillment by really embracing his feminine side through drag, he sort of starts to realize that he's actually nowhere near as comfortable staying closeted and hidden as he once thought.
Yeah, interesting. And probably a subject that a lot of people can relate to.
It was only after I'd written it that I read it back and I was like, oh, I've put a lot of my own sort of thoughts and feelings into this about, you know, sort of the idea that, as a gay man, you know, am I being too feminine? How am I being perceived? Like, should I be more masculine? And then you start to interrogate the question of like, well, why would I want to present more masculine if that's not sort of true to who I am? And why is masculine inherently seen as, you know, better than feminine? So there's a lot of kind of thorny stuff about like masculinity and queerness in there. But I hasten to add, it is just like it's a big, funny rom-com, I promise.
No, but all those things are, as I say, questions and feelings that a lot of gay men will have felt and asked themselves over the years.
Yeah, I think my first book was kind of a much more escapist heist story. My assignment that I kind of gave myself was like, write something that I would want to read on the beach, you know, just something really light and escapist. And then with this one, like, it's still very much like it's a romp, it's funny, it's romantic, but it's a bit more grounded in reality. And because one of the main characters is... you know, a gay man, you know, in his early 30s who lives in Birmingham. I kind of, a lot of very real stuff went into that.
So where does New York in the 40s come into it?
So, yeah, there's a dual timeline that follows Charles and Iris, who are a married couple in post-war Brooklyn. And they are the original creators of Captain Kismet, which is the kind of fictional superhero that Patrick is playing on the screen. And so it's showing how the origins of the character relate to, you know, the way that he's being played in the present day, and how there's... a queer backstory to this superhero as well, because his creators, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say, his creators are living in a lavender marriage, and they are both they're both gay, and so it's sort of about how even though you've got this incredibly masculine all-American superhero, actually the people creating him were doing something quite subversive.
Wow, that's really interesting. So did you have to do a bit of research into 1940s New York?
I was very, very lucky that I actually went to Brooklyn a couple of years ago. So there was a lot of kind of on the ground, like just walking around trying to soak up vibes and reading sort of some mid-century like pulpy stories and obviously watching lots of superhero films. And it's also... there's a very, very similar subject matter, which is covered in one of my favorite novels of all time, which is The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And so it's kind of, I'm going to say I'm riffing and I'm paying homage rather than stealing outright.
Yeah, nice. And I love the title as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, as soon as I kind of realized that's what I wanted to call it, a lot of things fell into place. I love song titles, you know, or lyrics as book titles. There's a lot of that happening at the moment, especially in romance. And it's just really nice because the minute you see a book on the shelf, you kind of connect with it. You hear the tune in your head. And also, like, you know, David Bowie, if we're talking kind of gender fluid kind of camp icons, you can't get much better than that.
Yeah, brilliant. So I'm assuming, even though Love and Other Scams was your debut, and you obviously will always love your debut novel, is this something a bit more personal for you then?
Yeah, and yeah, there's always like, I think it's anything that you're working on is currently like your favorite thing, right? Because it's the one that has all of your attention and your energy. But yeah, it's because it's so much about the city where I live. A lot of the characters are really inspired by people in my life. I feel very, very tenderly towards it.
Yeah, nice. So have you thought about book three yet?
Yes, so I'm currently in the middle of working on book three. I was working on a couple of different ideas, and my agent basically said to me, like, you have to just sit down and work on one thing, otherwise we're never going to get a third book out there. So yeah, it's another love story, and it's more about the love that you have with your friends. It's about a big group of friends in the mid-2000s, just sort of following them through their lives, through the ups and downs, and I'm having a lot of fun with all of the sort of, you know, nostalgic pop culture. I've got an amazing 2005 playlist on the go at the moment.
Oh, brilliant. Love it. Love the sound of that. Well, if people want to get a copy of We Could Be Heroes, it's out now. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by PJ Ellis, who we've been chatting with today. PJ, do get in touch with us when the next book is out, won't you? It'll be great to chat again.
I would love to. Yes, thank you.
Okay, thanks, PJ. Thanks for joining us.
Cheers.
TRE, your voice in Spain. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Hannah Pilvinen. She is the author of the novel We Sinners, which received a Whiting Award and a Balkans Fiction Prize. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her latest novel, The End of Drum Time, which was shortlisted for a National Book Award. It pivots around the relationship between a minister's daughter and a reindeer herder's son, set in the 1850s in Lapland. Welcome to the Book Show, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's lovely to have you with us. So tell me about your background. You live in the States, but you're obviously not from the States.
Yeah, so I'm a fourth generation, as we call it here in the States. I'm a fourth generation Finn, which means that all of my great-great-grandparents came from Finland. And so my family, like, you know, we're obviously pretty American, as you can hear from my accent. And we're also super Finnish. And I was raised in this Finnish religion. And that's what I was told it was my whole life. And then when I went to research this book, lo and behold, I figure out it actually has roots in the indigenous people of Europe in the Sami culture.
Wow, how interesting. So tell us about this book then and the setting of the 19th century.
Yeah, so it's taking place at this time of really big change for the Sami people. They've been, you know, the missionaries have been there for hundreds of years trying to, you know, convert them to Christianity. And it's kind of on the surface, they're saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. But really, they're doing whatever they want. And in terms of what they actually believe. And then this guy comes named Lars Levi Listadius, and he's a preacher. And he's, you know, preaching to the herds. He's going around on skis. And for the first time, he really starts to have some success. And for the first time, the Sami people start converting other people, like in their own communities, to Christianity. So it's this huge turning point. And the Christianity that they're turning to is the same kind of Christianity that I grew up in the United States. And it's super fundamentalist. So a lot of this book was me trying to figure out, how did this start? Why would this be in any way popular in this time and place? Like, what's the draw here? Like, what could be the appeal, since this was a religion that, you know, it took me, you know, some serious time and effort to get out of.
Interesting. And were you surprised with what you found?
I was, you know, I think I had originally thought, you know, oh, this religion, you know, it's a Christianity, you know, it's this, you know, colonizing force. It's just kind of coming in and changing everything, which is true. But I hadn't realized that the minister who started it, that he himself was half Sami. His mother was Sami, you know, she put him on her back and, skied with him for 40 miles in the snow to get him baptized, you know. So it's like there's actually something much more complicated happening. And I think that because he was Sami was part of the reason that the religion became popular. But I also think that there were aspects of the Christianity that he was preaching that were inherently a little Sami, actually. And it wasn't until later I started realizing, okay, this is why the religion I grew up in was different from the Christianity around me.
Yeah,
it really wasn't the same thing.
And what exactly is Sami?
Yeah, that's a great question. You have to go read the book. No, you know, it's a little tough to say. I would say it's an emphasis on feeling over knowledge, which in some ways you could say, okay, that's all religion. But I would say that this church is particularly consumed with that. And there's this idea that, you know, your intuition is knowledge. And not only that, but they have this ritual of a forgiveness of sins that I grew up in, that I became interested, like, you know, does that really have Sami roots, that kind of thing. So that whole, the whole experience was extremely surprising. And to research it, I was staying with a family of Sami reindeer herders. And I started realizing when I would be hanging out with them, you know, they were not Christian at all. And they didn't talk much about religion one way or another, but just the way they talked about things, you know, oh, I have a feeling we should do this. Oh, I have a feeling we should do that. I started realizing that there was these moments where it sounded like I was at church, for lack of a better phrase. And I just found I had a really unexpected connection with them.
Interesting. So do you feel like you're Sami then?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I wouldn't say quite that. But on the other hand, I loved being there. I loved the dramatic landscape and the setting, which is so much also what my book is about, is, you know, kind of this feeling that you get, you know, if you're looking at the Northern Lights and, you know, as a contemporary, you know, educated person, I can stand there and say, that's the magnetosphere. That's the magnetosphere. That's the magnetosphere. But my feelings are going, this is crazy, and I think this guy is going to come eat me, you know, if it's like a really intense Northern Lights show, I suppose that is. So there's always this conflict between rationality and irrationality just all the time that you experience up there from the land. And I think that's baked into the religion.
Yeah, interesting. So Sami, when I heard the word, I thought it was, I didn't realize it was connected to religion. I thought it was to do with indigenous Scandinavia, but that's not correct then, no?
No, it is indigenous. You are right. It's the indigenous people. It's just that this particular religion became popular among them.
Right, okay.
And it's like, it's sort of like the version of Christianity that they made, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. So there's lots of religious Sami people now, still today.
Sure. Yeah. And still in this particular religion. Yeah. And there's also Sami people who are still followers of the original, you know, the old religion, the pre-Christian, you know, they're a group like any other. They, you know, they have people of all kinds.
Yeah, interesting. And what about Lapland, this particular area that you've set it? It's difficult, I think, for people to imagine Lapland and its vastness and its beauty, because a lot of people just think of reindeer and Santa Claus, don't they?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, it extends from the tundra to the fells, you know, to the fjords by the sea. And it's really quite a wide range of land, like, you know, the western territory of Norway, and then into through northern Sweden, northern Finland, into eastern Russia. And so Sapmi, as the Sami call it, is really, you know, the ancestral land. And you know, there's Sami who herd reindeer, but there's also Sami who fish. There's also Sami who are, you know, live in the forests and hunt, right? So we also kind of have like some limited ideas about what they are, because I think we get attracted to the idea of the reindeer because the reindeer are just kind of cool.
And what about the title, The End of Drum Time? Where does that come from?
Yeah, so it comes from this old Sami phrase, actually. It's a translation of it. And it's really a single word, really. And it's the word that they have for when the missionaries first came. And so the pre-Christian religion, you know, used shamans and drums to sort of divine all kinds of things, from what we would think of as like the more supernatural world, you know, to, you know, speak with the dead maybe, but also to do more mundane things like what should we move the reindeer? When would be a good time to head to the sea? That kind of thing. And so when the Christian missionaries came, you know, and this also happened in America, you know, they burned the shamans at the stake. They took their drums. And so the Sami learned pretty quickly that you had to hide their drums, that they had to hide their drums. And so the phrase, the end of drum time, is their own term for Christianity. So I was kind of trying to contrast that, right, with this coming of like this new Christianity, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, if people want to learn more and get a copy of The End of Drum Time, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section. And it's by Hannah Pilvinen, who we've been chatting with today. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. Talk Radio Europe.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by audible.co.uk. Download one title each month, plus unlimited listening to thousands of Audible originals, podcasts, and audiobooks. Just click on the Audible banner at www.tre.radio.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to the second part of tonight's book show. In the first hour, we were chatting with William Coles, PJ Ellis, and Hannah Pilvinen. In this hour, we're chatting to Angelica Lopez. She's a novelist, screenwriter, and journalist from Rio de Janeiro with over 20 years of experience in writing fiction. She's written Brazilian soap operas known worldwide for attracting millions of viewers every day. She's also an award-winning author of young adult novels and has written scripts for cinema, TV, and comedy shows. The Curse of the Flores Women is her first adult novel and was sold for translation in France and Italy, even before being published in her native Brazil. It's a haunting novel about the enduring bonds of womanhood. We're also chatting to Maria de Fatima Santos, who was born in Angola and brought up in Portugal. She moved to Scotland in 2007 to work in social care. She has a profound love of the natural world and is deeply interested in regenerative projects in agriculture, horticulture, and forestry. Her writing stems from her passions for nature, Celtic culture, and storytelling, all of which she explores in her debut novel, Serendipity. It's an exciting book for children that takes the form of a tale told by a grandmother to her granddaughter, is a tribute to Maria's own grandmother. We also chat with Toby Clements. He's a journalist, former literary editor at the Daily Telegraph, and the author of the Kingmaker series, four critically acclaimed novels set during the Wars of the Roses. His latest novel, A Good Deliverance, is about the life of Sir Thomas Malory, a man at odds with his past and the events that inspired him whilst he was in jail to write the first great work of prose fiction in English. And finally, on tonight's book show, Inez G. Labata. She's a queer and immigrant writer living in the northwest of England. Her new novel, The Three Lives of St. Kieran, was shortlisted for the Northern Writers Awards. It has some experimental English prose heavily infused with Spanish, both in terms of language and culture. Part of it was born out of Inez's experience as a Spanish immigrant living in Ireland and the UK. Tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Treat yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
Joining us on the line now is Angelica Lopez. She's a novelist, screenwriter and journalist from Rio de Janeiro with over 20 years of experience in writing fiction. She's written Brazilian soap operas known worldwide for attracting millions of viewers daily. She's also an award-winning author of young adult novels and has written scripts for cinema, TV series and comedy shows. She's with us on the book show to talk about her first adult novel. It's called The Curse of the Flores Women. It was sold for translation in France and Italy even before being published in her native Brazil. It's a haunting novel about the enduring bonds of womanhood. Welcome to the book show, Angelica.
Hi, thank you, Hannah. Thank you for having me. I'm so glad to be here chatting with you today.
Oh, it's lovely to have you with us. And tell us then about the experience of writing your first adult novel compared to young adult stuff you've written before.
Okay, in my process, I normally start with an issue that I'm passionate about. In this case, the feminism. I'm a mom of Dora. She is 20 years old now. And I see how her generation is much more open about discussing sexism, misogyny, female body autonomy, compared to mine, my mother's, my grandmother's. So I observe these young girls nowadays go to streets, shout and fight for their rights. We see many movements like Me Too and others. But women still continue to be killed by their partners. And my writing is my way to contribute to change that.
Yes.
Since it is a historical novel set in Brazil countryside in the 1910s, I did a lot of research. And I discovered the work of one of Brazil's first feminists, one of whom I included as a character in story. That's the way that the story is related to my other literature.
Yeah. Because, so tell us about this woman in history that you found out about.
It's the first feminist in the specific time that I choose. Has to be with this also. And I chose this specific time period because it was the beginning of feminist movements in Brazil. The law of separation of bodies, in very specific case only, dates back to 1916. And the first feminist society was founded in 1919. So that I choose this era to to set my story, né? In the beginning of the feminism, and the location as well, because the place where the book is set is called Sertão. It is in northwest Brazil, and it's a very isolated region, and has a very dry landscape, and the struggle for survival. There is a daily reality for who lives there, even now. Imagine back then in the early 1900s.
So
it was a place very far from the capital. And the laws were not properly applied. Because who is in charge in those small cities were the landowner, the farmer. He owns everything, even people. My great-grandmother was born in a small town, in the same region, in the same era. So I get inspired from this as well.
Yeah, lovely. So tell us about the lace making. That's a big part of the book and the story.
Yeah, it's a plot. The book begins in Rio de Janeiro, in the present day, with this girl, Alice. Is a young feminist who attends protests and is very rebellious. And she inherits a lace veil for an aunt. And that veil has a violent story woven into the stitches. She didn't notice at first, but she cracked the lace code and became obsessed with uncovering the secret hidden in the veil. So the heart of the narrative is in the past, 100 years before Alice, when we met this fictional family of lace makers, the florists, that the title of the book, who are surrounded by this mysterious curse. The curse is, for 7 generations, every man who comes into their lives and crosses their path, father, sons, brothers, husband, and ends up dying young. No one knows why. There is no explanation for that. And my intention as a writer with this plot was to show that this curse, while raising prejudice and suspicion about the family, also allows the florist family to live more freely. There is no male supervision in their home. So the reader can easily understand that the curse is in fact a blessing in some way, and when one of them falls in trouble and is forced into a marriage with a violent and powerful man, they find a clever way to support her by encoding message hidden in the lace to communicate with each other. I think the book does talk about the power of the sisterhood and the power of communication, even the silent communication. I chose lace, as you asked me, because it's a domestic activity that seems harmless and quiet. Even the body posture is bent, the head turned down. But through the silence, my characters are fighting. So when the women have no voice, they have to create another form of communication. And that what the florist women do in the book for the lace.
That's amazing. So in your research, did you find that this actually happened, that women communicated through stitching in lace? Or is that something you came up with for the story?
We have escape. We have suffering, but it was common in the past, messages, not in secret, but to encoded between girlfriend and boyfriends as love letters, in some cases in a handkerchief, in a piece of tissue. But I actually learned in Broadway as part of my research. I took classes to understand the mindset behind lace making, the silence, the breathing, the breathing, the movements. I did simple things in my classes, in broader classes, of course, nothing too difficult. But it was essential for me in a process of writing. The pieces that I made are now decorating here in my home in Brazil alongside the book's editions. And ironic, my grandmother tried to teach me knitting and crochet when I was a child. But I only learned to do one stitch after another, like an endless string, you know. but I think this image, the a grandmother teaching a granddaughter, also represents the intention of the book, the connection between present and past, the knowledge passed from generation to generation. It was interesting.
Yeah, it must have been interesting going to the different classes. And I'm fascinated that a lot of the time there was silence and it was almost a meditative experience.
Yeah, it seems harmless, seems the activity has a little bit of submission, but it's not true. We are making something. Creating something, so it's an action.
I'm sure if there were classes in the UK of knitting classes and things like that with women, they'd be talking the whole time and probably drinking wine as well.
I think in UK it will be tea.
It's funny. So so you really enjoyed writing this book then. Do you think you'll write more adult fiction after this?
Yeah, yeah. In fact, my less young books, it's already adults. It's for a book more, I talk about depression, about bullying. So in my career, I'm already writing themes more profound in the latest years. Yeah. And now The Curse of the Flor Zooms is a book that is giving to me many joy. It's been launched by Amazon now in English, but with the wonderful translation by Zoe Perry. But it also translated into Italian, French, Portugal, Poland. And we have already arranged for publication in Turkey and Romania.
That's fantastic.
So it's fantastic for me from Brazil. And in my opinion, the interest from other countries stem from the societal need to discuss this theme, this so important theme that it's violence domestic and against the women. We need to discuss that.
Oh, definitely. It's shocking that in this day and age, it's still an issue. Well, it should never have been an issue, obviously, but particularly now. I read that in Brazil, one woman is killed every 6 hours, majority by their partners or ex-partners. That's horrific.
Yeah. Last year, we saw a 22% increase in domestic violence against women, with one woman being killed every 6 hours. It's a heartbreaking reality. And recently, a congressman tried to propose a law project that would result in the criminal of a rape facing less prison time than a victim who chose to have an abortion. So it's a so real reality. The law didn't pass, of course. The society fights against. But it's important to be vigilant and the conservative mindset in Brazil and any other countries as well remains. So the fight for women's rights persists even more.
Yeah.
That's why I decided to write the story in two times, because it's not a story of Beth only. Né? It's our story now.
Yeah.
Nowadays.
Well, well done for telling a very important story, and I wish you a lot of luck with the book all around the world with all the different translations. It's called The Curse of the Flores Women, and it's available on our website, tre.radio. It's by Angelica Lopez, who we've been chatting with today. Angelica, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much, Hannah. It was a pleasure. And sorry, my English, because it's not so fluent. I don't know if you understand everything.
We understood everything perfectly. Your English is brilliant. Well done.
Thank you, Hannah. Bye-bye.
TRE.
Hello, little Alan Bennett here. If I'm not writing books, then the thing I like most is listening to the book club. On Talk Radio Europe. Fancy.
Joining us on the line now is Maria de Fatima Santos. She was born in Angola and brought up in Portugal. She moved to Scotland in 2007 to work in social care and now divides her time between Scotland and Portugal. She has a profound love of the natural world and is deeply interested in regenerative projects in agriculture, horticulture and forestry. Her writing stems from her passions for nature, Celtic culture and storytelling, all of which she explores in her debut novel, Serendipity. It's an exciting novel for children, which takes the form of a tale told by a grandmother to her granddaughter, set in the traveller community and against the backdrop of spectacular and mystical locations in Scotland. And it's a tribute to Maria's own grandmother. Welcome to the book show, Maria.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for joining us. And how lovely for this book to be a tribute to your grandmother. That's very nice.
Yes, it's a very profound feeling. My grandmother is not alive anymore. She was very old, and it's a tribute to her. And just the curiosity, the name Julia, the name of the grandmother in the story, is also the name of my grandmother. So it's a tribute.
Ah, nice. So how did you get the idea of the story, the idea, of a grandmother telling a story to a grandchild?
Well, it has been a journey. This idea, I was in Scotland when I moved in 2007 to Scotland. And in 2008, I was sitting in a garden, in a bench in Edinburgh. And because Edinburgh is a city so linked with literature and books, you know, and I think it's UNESCO City of Literature. So I was there and I was reading children's books as well to learn my English, to improve. I started reading a lot. And I was sitting in that bench and I had kind of inspirations. Why I like to write a children's story as well, you know, in English. Because I really love English. I learned to love English there in Scotland. And that first glimpse of an idea to write a children's story just came to me. And as I was living my experience there as well, working and studying English, and then many things, inspirations came to me. And the idea of a grandmother telling a story, it just came. It makes sense because it's a story that takes us back to a past in Scotland where the tribal people, they really live that kind of life, you know, in the agriculture. They didn't have a house. They were very nomads. So, and it came to me, it makes sense. A grandmother telling a story to a granddaughter in this century, in our time, but take us back to a past time. So that was my beginning.
Yes, lovely. So how old is the granddaughter in the story?
I'm 8 years old, and actually, you know, the story is really for mid-grade children, so it can be from 8 till 12, but in my story, I imagine a little girl 8 years old.
Nice. And are there other members of the family in the book, or is it all between the grandmother and the granddaughter?
Only the grandmother and the granddaughter, and it starts with a cloudy morning, with a fog. I was inspired by London because I thought, you know, in London, there was this kind of idea, the pollution in the air. And And it's not like the attraction, because London has many green parks. But I thought in something, there is a weather, the weather is cloudy, is fog, and the girl cannot go out to play. And the granddaughter starts telling her a story to her for her to be more happy. Mm. And it's an intimate relationship between the grandmother and the granddaughter.
Nice. So tell us about the different settings in Scotland, because you go to some beautiful, magical places there.
Yes, magical indeed. And that place, the particularity of this story is that that three places that are real, I visited them when I was living in Scotland, because I love, I had a camera, a very old camera with me in that time. And I love photography, garden photography and nature. I just love it. And I used to take my camera when I was off and go to visit place. And the three places, the one I was there and I photographed it. The first is the Health Hall. I think I'm pronouncing well the name. Helga's Hall in Forest. That is really like a kind of a wild garden. It's like a hole in the middle of a woodland in Forest that is in the north, in near Inverness. I lived there for a while and I could photograph that place, and it's magical with many wildflowers and trees. And the second place, the second setting I also photographed and visit is the Hermitage Forest in Dunkeld. Also really magical. And the last one, for me, the most magical of all of them, it's Glen Lyon. That is, it's in Perth, near Perth. And it's known, I read in a book, Glen Lyon is known as the longest, the loneliest, and the loveliest glen in Scotland. And it's really, it has atmosphere on its own. It's very related with the Pict. The Celtic tribes live there in the past. There are many standing stones there. It's beautiful. It's very unique. And I recommend who wants to travel to Scotland to visit, because it's beautiful.
Lovely. And where does the Celtic mythology come into the story?
Well, that was another discovery along my journey in Scotland. I discovered I really love the Celtic culture. I feel drawn to the Celtic culture because they combine such a veneration for nature, and it's just beautiful, the art, the poetry, and how I could integrate the Celtic culture in this story mythology was I start reading books and I found the veneration of the Celts to the sun god Lugh. The Lugh was the son of the god Sun. And also I read a book called speaking about the Celiar, and the Celiar, it's like was the goddess of the ancestors, and try to put all this together in a story for children. Glen Lyon helped me a lot, because in Glen Lyon, there was, according to books of history, there are records about the Pict people, the Celts, they venerate the sun god Lugh. So that's in my story in the Glen Lyon. There, it's about the sun god Lugh is in the story and is in Glen Lyon. And also something very curious I discovered in Glen Lyon. There is really a Celiar veneration in that glen. I was told, and there is books speaking about that, that in the local communities of Glen Lyon, they used in the past every year, when the winter was starting, they used to venerate the Celiar. There is a place in Glen Lyon where there is a kind of, it's something built with stones. Like it's a monument, but I don't know the right name in English, but it's a monument with stones. And the people believe that was for the Celiar. So they had stones, and when the winter was coming every year, the people that believe in the Celiar, the local people, would go there doing a veneration to that place, praying and asking for the winter to be good for them, to protect the animals, you know, the cattle. So this is traditions I discovered in Glen Lyon, and I try somehow to, in my story, to mention the Celiar and the sun god Lugh
Yeah, yes. Nice. And what about the alphabet of the trees? I've not heard of that before.
Yeah, that's another fascinating thing about the Celts. You know, the Celts, and we go back to the Druids people. So another fascinating thing I learned about the Celts is that the Druid people, they were very respected in the Celtic tribes, and they were known as very wise men, a kind of philosophers or theologians, or maybe priests in our days. And they were so wise, and they were very respected to give advice to the people and even to the kings in the tribes. And they created alphabet for trees. I was really enthusiastic when, and there are books speaking about that. It means, I think, they create for each tree a symbol. And each tree, that symbol, it's the alphabet. And if I am not in mistake, forgive me if I don't say it well, but I think it's 20. There are 20 signs in that alphabet. I have to check, but I think it's around 20. Each symbol corresponds to a tree. And it's a tree, it's alphabet of the tree, it's called Oum.
Wow, how interesting. You've learned a lot.
Yes, it fascinates me, you know. I think it's very beautiful.
And what about the traveler community? How does that come into the story?
Yes, that was another interesting finding. When I was in Edinburgh, I came across a book, a little book called Red Rowans and Wild Honey. And it was written by Betsy White. And Betsy White was a child born in a travel family. Maybe speaking the 19th century, maybe 20th century, 90s, yeah, I think it's from the 20th century. But she was born in that family, and she lived the life of their parents as a traveler. And she was an amazing storyteller. And she wrote some books, and I found her book by chance in a charity shop. I used to go buy books there because they were very affordable, and I want to improve my English. And I read her book as a personal account of her life. And I was fascinated. And I said, wow, this is amazing. So my story, my children's story, was already in the back of my mind. I said, I can pick this idea, a travel child and a mother. And it all makes sense, because one of the things I learned about travel communities, and they are still in Scotland, but I think not with a way of life so nomad like in the past, I think, but they are still descendants from tribal people, and they are considered the oldest indigenous group of the Scottish population, because they have a tradition on their own, the way of life, even their culture of storytelling. So this all clicked together for my story. I put all the points together. I said, this is a beautiful inspiration. And that's how I got to the travel people, and it was by the book I read.
Oh, that's really amazing.
I just would like to say a word of acknowledgement to my publisher. It's just to say thank you to Palavro, because Palavro is a publisher, is an imprint of Arcbound Foundation, and they are based in Glasgow and Bristol, but they do something very different. They support aspiring authors, people like me, to have a voice, you know, through the writing word and to get published. And they are very directed to communities and individuals that are on the edge. And I know, you know, by experience that in the times of crisis, like the one we are living in, it's always from the edge that great insights come. And I just want to acknowledge the support they give to many authors for the work they are doing.
Oh, that's lovely. And that's Palavro Publishing, an imprint of the Arcbound Foundation.
Yes.
Well, it's lovely to have you with us on the show, Maria de Fatima Santos. Thank you very much for joining us. And if listeners want to get a copy of Serendipity, A Long Journey Starts with a Small Step, they can go to our website, tre.radio. Maria, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
TRE, your voice in Spain. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Toby Clements. He's a journalist and former literary editor at the Daily Telegraph. He's the author of the Kingsmaker series, four critically acclaimed novels set during the Wars of the Roses. He's with us on the book show to talk about his latest novel, A Good Deliverance. It's all about the life of Sir Thomas Malory, who wrote his chivalric masterpiece while in jail, charged with, though never convicted of, a terrible crime. It's the captivating tale of a man at odds with his past and the events that inspired him to write the first great work of prose fiction in English. Welcome to the book show, Toby.
Thank you very much. Very nice to be here.
It's great to have you with us. So this is very exciting. Tell us a bit more about Sir Thomas Malory and how you found out so much about him.
Well, there is not actually very much known about him. He's an interesting character. It's only very recently that they sort of academics discovered that he was who he was. There were about five or six Thomas Malorys who could have written Morte d'Arthur, which is the chivalric masterpiece that he's best known for. And they did not know who he was. He could have been someone from, there was someone from Huntingdonshire, there was someone from Devon, and I think there was, might even have been someone from Scotland who could have been Thomas Malory, but the academics in the last sort of 10 or 15 years finally pinned down that he came from Northampton or Warwickshire on the sort of borders, and he had a very rackety late life. No one knows exactly how he passed his early life, when he was born or anything like that. But if it's the right Sir Thomas Malory, then he did end up in jail, and he wrote this masterpiece while he was in jail, charged with numerous crimes, one of them extremely serious. And I don't know if I'm spoiling the plot if I tell you what it is. So I won't tell you what it is, just in case I'm doing that.
Yes. But tell us about this masterpiece that he wrote in jail. It's all to do with King Arthur, isn't it?
That's it. It's the story of King Arthur. It starts with King Arthur's slightly dodgy birth, which is when his father, Uther Pendragon, tricked his mother by disguising himself as his mother's husband and sneaking into her bed then while her first husband, he then did marry her, Uther Pendragon did marry her, while her first husband was being killed at a battle with Uther Pendragon's troops. And that's where Merlin first appears. And so Uther Pendragon begets Arthur on, I mean, it is effectively rape because he's disguised as her husband and magically disguised. Not, he doesn't just dress up as her, but with Merlin's help. And he then, she doesn't know that Arthur is Arthur, and the deal with Merlin is that Merlin takes Arthur when he's born, and he gives him to a sort of step-parents, Sir Ector in T.H. White's version. And then, so Arthur grows up not knowing who he is, and then he stumbles onto the Sword in the Stone and pulls the Sword of the Stone out and is rightwise claimed rightwise King of all England. And from there on, it's about his life, how he goes on to found the Round Table, and how he sets off, how his knights set off to find the Holy Grail, and then how eventually his own son, begot in slightly dodgy circumstances as well, kills him at a big battle at the end of the book, Morte d'Arthur, 800 pages later, he kills him. And it's really about the death of an almost perfect civilization, according to Malory. If you read it yourself, it does not seem that perfect, but he really loved all this business of knights and fighting, endless jousting. But it's really about the decline of a political era, in a way, the decline of internal entropy and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And in parts, it's absolutely brilliant, really magical, but in other parts, it's desperately turgid. But he did have a long time to write it. He was in prison for about 10 years, off and on, and he used it as occupational therapy. Do I mean occupational? When you're just passing the time.
Yes.
He just passed the time writing this book. And so there are some very strange passages that just seem to wander off into nowhere. And then he ends Fourth Wall, which is, you know, it was written in 1485 or printed in 1485. It is really strange. Suddenly the author is talking straight directly to the reader, which is kind of revolutionary. The whole thing is very unusual because he sort of invents the form of the novel, really.
Yeah.
So it is groundbreaking and revolutionary and very interesting, but also not in large parts.
Yeah. So all the stories that we hear about King Arthur and the Round Table, Sir Lancelot, Guinevere, all of that, did that all come from Thomas Malory then?
No, to be fair, synthesized, or they came from, there are lots of very, you know, diverse myths and legends from written in Breton and Welsh and Gaelic and French, and he put them all together in English. And
okay.
he got rid of a lot of the songs and the poetry of it, and he made it in very brusque, straightforward English. And because he was a soldier and a politician, and so he was speaking to soldiers and politicians at the time. So it's not poetic, it's not flowery. Lots of the earlier versions, Chrétien de Troyes was where he got lots of it from, were nonsensical. They would start singing, and I think you get the sense when you read more Arthur that he was a bit impatient with that, and he wanted it to be. It was a sort of a worship of honour, really. A paean to honour,
yes,
is really what it was, and not paean to singing and waltzing around.
So the fact that it was made into a musical hundreds of years later, he probably wouldn't have liked that.
Oh, my God. I think he was a very crotchety character. I think he would have gone in there and killed absolutely everybody involved. he's not a merciful man, I think, really.
So was it fun doing all the research for this and piecing all the different bits together? Obviously, you're used to doing a lot of research with the Kingmaker series.
Yeah, I liked it. The Kingmaker series, the thing I loved most about the Kingmaker series was writing about how ordinary people lived, discovering that. So that was sort of granular research, whereas this was more piecing together sort of events. And Kingmaker books are about people living fairly low status. And Thomas Malory, for a long time, was quite high status until he ended up in jail. But even then, it wasn't like a dungeon. He had a private room in the top tower of Newgate. So he was quite well looked after. But it was great. I mean, it was startling in a way, because I think when I started it because I had really loved all. I quite liked that musical of, you know, the Camelot and stuff. But I, as a kid, I liked all the T.H. White books and the Disney version and stuff like that, Sword in the Stone. But then when I read more about him, the more interesting he gets. So it was really quite a revelation. And this business of the crime that he's charged with was really quite disturbing. So it was really interesting, given that he had written all about chivalry and honour and worship and stuff like that, that then he was, in fact, in some senses, a real wrong'un. You know, he became a very different character as my research wore on. You know, I had started out with an idea of him being one way, and then it turned out he was very different.
And do you know how people felt about him after he did his time and having wrote this in prison?
Well, it's interesting because I think he died in prison having just finished it. So they reckon he finished it in about 1470, and it was, you know, written like a prison diary on all sorts of pieces of paper. I am imagining there's no actual trace of his writing. You know, it was copied up afterwards, and Caxton printed it in 1485, so 15 years later. And in his introduction, he says he was constantly sort of badgered by great men, diverse great men, which would suggest sort of nobility And it was just the end of Richard III's reign when England was descending into exactly the kind of turmoil that Thomas Malory had predicted. And I think the idea was it was going to be circulated amongst the wealthy and amongst the gentry as an example of how, as a sort of political example, as a sort of an allegory, almost, you know, sort of, it's properly political. Don't do this because this will happen. And so I think it was appreciated very much by sort of a warlike class, because, as I say, there is lots of fighting in it.
Mm.
And how kings should rule and how knights should be, how ladies should be. They rather overlooked his crimes because I think they were probably wise. They probably knew that he hadn't committed the crime of which he is most... the most serious crime, probably hadn't committed it, so they would have not have turned against him, if you see what I mean.
Well, if people want to read the book, it's called A Good Deliverance. It's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Toby Clements, who we've been chatting with today. Toby, thanks so much for joining us.
Not at all. It was a great pleasure. Thank you very much, Hannah.
TRE, Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Inez G. Labata. She's a queer and an immigrant writer living in the northwest of England. Her new novel, The Three Lives of St. Kieran, was shortlisted for the Northern Writers Awards. It's experimental English prose, heavily infused with Spanish, both in terms of language and culture. Part of it was born out of her experiences as a Spanish immigrant, first in Ireland and then in the UK. Welcome to the book show, Inez.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's lovely to have you with us. So you're from Madrid?
Yes, yes, originally from Madrid, that's it. But I've been living here in the UK for 10 years now.
Oh, lovely. And you're very happy there, I understand.
As much as I miss the sun from Spain, yes.
Yes, I bet you do miss the sun. I was reading that you don't like the word expat. You very much think of yourself as an immigrant.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, it wasn't like that from the very beginning. But I think especially, you know, after Brexit, there's been so much, I suppose, comments about, you know, immigrants, and being seen in a negative view, I suppose, that to me it is important to say I am an immigrant, because I guess that's what I am. I am, you know, I graduated in Spain in university in 2014, and there were not many job opportunities for me there to do what I wanted. And I moved away, first to Ireland, now to the UK. And, you know, it was here in the northwest of England that I found a really vibrant and nurturing writing community that, you know, I was never able to find in Madrid, for example. So I'm very happy to be here, I suppose, as an immigrant as well. And I guess that's why I don't like the word.
Yeah.
I don't know the word expat all that much. Yeah.
Yeah. No, good for you. And you're a creative writing lecturer at Lancaster University. Is that right?
Yes. Yes, I am indeed. Yeah. I'm a writer and I'm also a lecturer. Yeah.
So that must be nice, being around other people who are passionate about writing.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I love this job. I had many, many jobs since coming here, because I came here originally to do an MA in creative writing and then a PhD. So I was having all sorts of jobs while I was doing the PhD. But yeah, being a creative writing lecturer is obviously, you know, it's definitely my favorite. And again, here at Lancaster University, which is the place where I also did my PhD. So then when I finished, I moved down south, you know, to Plymouth for work and stuff. But I ended up coming back here. And it's really special because I think we have a small but very mighty creative writing department. And I am super proud to be part of it.
Oh, nice. So let's talk about your latest book. How is this different from other books you've written previously?
I think it's very different because I wrote it as part of my PhD thesis. So when you do a PhD in creative writing, a lot of people ask me, you know, what do you do in creative writing? And you pretty much, what you do is you write a novel. But because it's a PhD and it's happening in the context of the university, I was pushed to be as original as possible, right? Originality was really, really important. And that meant that this book is quite experimental. A part of it, not all the book, but one of the parts is written in this kind of like patois, kind of like a mixture of English and Spanish, which took me quite a while to devise. It's kind of similar to books like A Clockwork Orange, that I don't know if anyone knows about, obviously, very famous piece, you know, that is kind of like experimenting a bit with language.
Yeah.
So in that regard, yeah, I would say it's the most original and experimental novel I've ever attempted to write, which meant that it was actually also really difficult to find a publisher for it because of that. But I did in the end with Blackwater Press, which is a publisher based in Scotland and in the US. And yeah, that was a really nice journey.
So tell us who St. Kieran is.
So St. Kieran originally is a saint from Ireland. So that's where I moved first when I left Spain. I moved to this little town in Ireland called Athlone, which is right in the center of the island. And I was really close to this place called Clonmacnoise, which is what remains of a monastery there. And the legend says that St. Kieran was the one who founded this monastery, which was also one of the first universities in Europe. This was back in the 6th century Ireland. And back at that time, you know, religion and education were very much intertwined because obviously the monks had the books and they were copying the books and kind of like preserving knowledge. So I was very fascinated by the landscape, by this monastery in this really flat landscape, because if you visit the center of Ireland, it's really, really flat, but the skies are massive. And, you know, the River Shannon is just there as well. And yeah, I just wondered, who is this St. Kieran, you know? And one of the things that is said about him as well is that he had this special way with animals and he was always accompanied by a cow. And, you know, that really, I was there, you know, I was like, yeah, same with a cow. And I decided to kind of like imagine an alternative story for St. Kieran, you know, completely departing from the original me, if you want, and just bringing a lot of fiction into it.
So when is it set then?
So it has like actually three different timelines. So one timeline is 6th century Ireland, and it's kind of my version of the St. Kieran me. And in my version of the story, he's originally a Spanish pilgrim that ends up in Ireland almost by chance. Another timeline of the story is set in Madrid in the 1930s, and this is the time of the Second Spanish Republic, which was a really interesting period in Spain because it was a period marked for being really, really open, like women got the vote during that period for the first time in Spain. They were able to divorce, things like that. But of course, this is also right before the Spanish Civil War, which sent the country back centuries again.
Yeah.
And the third timeline is kind of like in an imagined future, if you want, and it's kind of like dystopic. Yeah, so those are the three timelines that kind of like are intertwined together through the figure of St. Kieran that appears in some way or another.
So did you have to do a lot of research both into 1930s Spain, but particularly into the 6th century, what life was like then?
That was really hard. I mean, as you can imagine, the 1930s in Spain, yeah, that was kind of like way easier. I even had my grandmother who lived through the Civil War and lived through those years, you know, and I could just sit down and ask her, and that was wonderful. I also was talking to someone whose father had been there in Madrid receiving the international brigades. So that was, you know, and I went to Madrid and did a lot of research there as well. But the 6th century Ireland was very, very challenging because, as you can imagine, there is almost nothing from that time, no actual text. And I think that was the part that was more challenging for me to write at the beginning because I just kept getting stuck. And I think eventually what I had to kind of like come to terms with is the fact that I write fiction and I'm not a historian. So nobody should go and pick my book thinking they're going to, you know, learn all of these facts about history. It's a story, really. And that kind of gave me the freedom to, imagine an alternative Ireland. And a lot of my research was actually going to specific locations in Ireland and featuring that part of the story, like Clonmacnoise, but also the Aran Islands, especially Inishmore, which has all these really fascinating remains, archaeological remains, and these little teeny tiny chapels that Irish saints had just built in an arid landscape.
Yeah. To just go. Well, I guess if it was really difficult for you to find a lot of information about 6th century Ireland, it would be difficult for other people as well. So it's not like you'll be bombarded with historical specialists from 6th century Ireland saying, no, this didn't happen then.
Yeah, nobody knows really. So you are kind of like filling in the gaps as a writer, I suppose.
Yeah. So now the book is out there, are you planning on writing another book?
Yes, I am actually already, I'm already writing something different. It's also kind of like historical fiction as well, but it's set in the Pacific Northwest in the 19th century. Yeah, and I was very lucky to get an Eccles Fellowship from the British Library. So I'm actually going there in a few weeks to the archives and the American archives in the British Library now to do some research.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So how did you get that? How does that come about?
The really good thing is like anyone can apply to these fellowships. The Eccles Institute for the Americas at the British Library kind of like offers them every year. And actually a friend of mine who is also a writer had got one and she recommended this to me. But literally anyone can apply with a project and it could be an academic project, but also a creative project. So, you know, for writers, singers, visual artist, and you just literally apply. And if you get it, they just basically give you money so you can go to London and be there at the library. And they are so, so kind. The researchers there have been so helpful so far. So anyone who... So the only thing is that obviously your research has something, it needs to be linked to the Americas in some way or another, obviously. But
Wow, that's really interesting. Fantastic. Well, if people want to get a copy of The Three Lives of St. Kieran, it's available now on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Inez G. Labata, who we've been chatting with today. Inez, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalog of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.